Appeals for November 9. I will ask the marshal to introduce the reconstituted panel. Thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Smith, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Thank you and welcome. This is what originally was scheduled as hearing number 3 for oral argument this morning. We did have a settlement in the second, so this is the case number 3. We have 3 non-oral matters that we will consider following this oral argument. The file number for this matter is A210455, State of Minnesota, which is the respondent, Jose Antonio Martinez Fuentes, appellant. Counsel should be able to see the 15 minutes and one of the boxes in your screen. We do ask you to keep an eye on that, of course. Appellant will have 15 minutes if you choose, and then 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant's counsel. We do ask also that you identify your name for the record before you begin your comments. And I'll just note that no separate recording of this proceeding is allowed other than the recording that you saw and heard a few moments ago. That'll be proceeding will also be available, therefore, on the Judicial Branch website within 24 hours. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kimberly Woods Vanslow on behalf of appellant Jose Antonio Martinez Fuentes. This case is about whether Mr. Martinez Fuentes has the right to withdraw his guilty plea through a post-conviction petition, which is based on an ineffective assistance of counsel, and when an exception to the timely filing of the post-conviction requirement applies, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 590.01 sub 4b. Mr. Martinez Fuentes was born in Guatemala. He came to the United States in 2005 with that legal status. He was convicted of aggravated forgery in the 8th Judicial District in Candiota County. He entered the plea of guilt on the record of October 16th of 2008. The remaining charges were dismissed. He subsequently learned that that plea was going to render him ineligible for certain immigration benefits. Mr. Martinez Fuentes came to met with Mr. Nguyen in our office in 2019, and we filed the motion for post-conviction shortly thereafter. So the issue here is whether, first of all, whether the requirement for Mr. Martinez Fuentes to be advised of the immigration consequences applies in his case, and additionally, whether he qualifies for that exception to the time bar for the post-conviction petition. So the attorney who represented Mr. Martinez Fuentes in his initial criminal matter has had his license has been suspended for 3 years with no option to renew his license sooner than that for various infractions involving many clients, involving money, involving bad advice, involving all kinds of things. Mr. Martinez maintains that he was not advised that that this plea would render him inadmissible for certain immigration benefits. And the standard is going to be higher in this case because the attorney who was advising him at the time was a well-known immigration attorney. So that attorney should have known that this plea would render Mr. Martinez Fuentes ineligible for certain immigration benefits above more than any other regular defense attorney. This attorney should have known that as he had been practicing immigration law for many, many years. He knew that this plea would render Mr. Martinez ineligible. So in order for Mr. Martinez to apply or file the post-conviction for post-conviction relief, he has to show that the petition is not frivolous, is in the interest of justice. So And then he has to show that there, he invokes the exception and has to file it within 2 years of when the interest of justice claim arises. Now, this case kind of hinges on when that interest of justice claim arose. So the issue is, when did Mr. Martinez Fuentes know or have reason to know that he was going to be prejudiced by this plea? So he did talk to another attorney who said, you know, we can't do anything for you. There's nothing we can do to help you until the immigration laws change. Mr. Martinez maintains that he knew of the injustice, that he only after he met with Mr. Nguyen in November of 2019, because that's when he learned.
Counsel, I'm sorry, before we get into the facts of his subjective knowledge, can you tell me why this case isn't governed by Sanchez, which sets an objective, not a subjective standard? And I think it talks about two things, actually, and I wanted to hear your response to both of those. The state divides this its response in two, saying that for this exception, the reason is what stopped the person from meeting the statute of limitations, not the merits of the underlying claim. That's one thing. And since it's all about the ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea, that didn't in any way cause the delay. And then that's when you measure it from. Well, I guess that's a substantive thing that they cannot be the same issue, right? And then secondly, when it gets measured from, even if they weren't, I guess, the same issue, on an objective standard, when does the know or should have known come into play? So can you talk to us about why you actually have a compelling argument here, given those two barriers to your position?
Yes, Your Honor. So pursuant to Sanchez, the claim arises when the claimant knew or should have known that there was a potential claim. So because he knew or should have known at the time that he came to see Mr. Nguyen in 2019 and was told at that time, there's nothing we can do, Our client's position is that is when his claim arose, is when he knew there's absolutely nothing you can do because of this claim. The action of what prohibited him from filing a claim sooner than that is, one, he didn't know that he had a claim. And secondly, he believed his attorney at the time. The attorney was an immigration attorney who told him, don't worry about it, you can come look for me later. You'll be fine. So he didn't think there was going to be a problem. And then when he did talk to another attorney, and another attorney told him, we can't do anything for you unless the laws changed, also prevented our client from knowing he had a claim at that point, because at that time, had he been told, okay, you can do something about this, he would have done something about it at that time. But he did not have that information.
Ms. Woods-Vanislow, you did not allege ineffective assistance of counsel against attorney number two, I guess we'll call that person. Is that right?
Correct.
And it seems to me that the district court's order was almost entirely reliant on the advice that that Mr. Martinez received from attorney number two as sort of the triggering date for when he knew that there was a problem. Is that right?
Yes, I think yes.
So what I'm hoping that you can explain to us is sort of how we get around the district court's reasoning, finding that, you know, the triggering event here for the post-conviction was the consultation with attorney number two, especially given that you haven't alleged ineffective assistance of counsel against that person.
Thank you, Your Honor. We are not alleging ineffective assistance of counsel for attorney number two. We are not claiming that Mr. Martinez was misadvised at that point. What Mr. Martinez is saying is that he still did not know to what extent he had been prejudiced by the plea that he entered. His thinking was, you know, we can't do anything for you until the laws have changed. He did not understand that there's nothing he can ever do until he met with Mr. Wynn in 2019 and then was told there's nothing anybody can do for you, that this is kind of the end of the line.
And then can you go back to, the state quotes the Hannon v. State case, which is Minnesota Supreme Court 2021 case that says, under the interest of justice exception, Hannon in that case, the defendant was required to allege an act or omission that prevented him from filing his petition before the 2-year limitations period expired, and that he didn't know or have reason to know, et cetera. We focus more on the latter part of the know or have reason to know. Why, what act or omission have you alleged, did you allege, that prevented him from filing his petition? It seems like the act or omission is the ineffective assistance of counsel prior to the plea. How did that stop? Well, how is that a separate act that prevented him from filing a petition?
He relied on the attorney one's advice completely. And so because of that, he didn't file a petition.
So any ineffective assistance of counsel claim during the course of a trial until someone subjectively learns that they got bad advice, I mean, do they all qualify under this? Interest of justice exception. I'm kind of trying to figure out what it means when the court, why that would be different from when the court says you have to, it can't be the same thing. We know it can't be the same act. Why that is not a problem for you here?
Well, Your Honor, because the attorney was, again, an immigration attorney, that attorney had a higher duty to give Mr. Martinez correct advice about this particular plea for immigration purposes. And Mr. Martinez relied on the fact that he said, come look for me and we'll work this out with no problem. We'll fix your status with no problem. And so because he relied on that, he didn't act.
Ms. Woods, can I follow up your answer to Judge Gaitis's question regarding the 2010 meeting with lawyer number two? You used the phrase, I think at the end of your answer, that he did not know that there was anything he could do. Did I paraphrase you correctly, if I recall your answer at the end, in terms of why he took no action?
He didn't know that he could file a post-conviction petition at that time.
But my question is, isn't that precisely what the Supreme Court has identified, though, as an objective standard, not as subjective? So even if we are to accept the argument, and it's a good one, and certainly at a minimum very sympathetic or empathetic situation where you have a well-known immigration lawyer giving bad advice, and that's the reason he was suspended ultimately from the practice. But my question is, isn't that objective standard the Supreme Court has clearly identified? Objectively, from that point forward, now knew that he had bad advice and needed to take action. Whether subjectively, did seems not to be our review. Am I incorrect on that regard?
I guess I think so. I'm looking at that differently, Your Honor. My client's thought is that he would have taken action had he known that he could take action. So had he known, even in 2010, after being told there's nothing we can, you know, nothing, you don't have a case until the laws changed. So had he known at that time that he could take action, or been presented with the ability to take action, he would have taken action at that point.
And what you're referring to, and I assume it to be true, was the immigration status, correct? The immigration lawyer, the Woods firm, told him, and no one disputes that, that you're basically out of luck until the law changes, right? But correct, my question is whether in applying an objective standard for the best interest or the interest of justice exception, post-conviction relief, isn't he charged with the knowledge whether he subjectively knew? Isn't that the point of the objective standard, as the Supreme Court has reiterated?
But if he didn't know, then he wouldn't take action. Am I? So for the interest of justice exception, the interest of justice exception arose for my client in 2019 when he knew there was nothing he could ever do to fix that, to take care of that status, that he would be prejudiced by that plea.
Thank you, Ms. Woods. No, I appreciate that. Did you have any final comment? You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Very good. Then, counsel for a respondent, you may identify yourself and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Juliana Passy, Assistant Kennedy Ojai County Attorney, on behalf of the state of Minnesota. In this case, the post-conviction court properly determined that appellant's petition was untimely and it failed to qualify for any exceptions of the 2-year time limit. Appellant fails to point to any legal error, any clearly erroneous factual finding, and as such, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the post-conviction petition, and the state would ask that this court affirm. I believe that this court has already focused on, you know, the two main questions. Does the petition even qualify first as an under the interest of justice exception, and second, if it does, is it time barred? And I think based on the case law cited by the state, the Sanchez case is very clear that the reasons can't be the same here. And here they are. The substantive claim of the petition is the same as the injustice that is claimed that allegedly prohibited Mr. Martinez Fuentes from filing his petition. We know it can't be the same. And here in this case, it is the same thing. This is the Supreme Court's limitation on the interest of justice exception. I don't think, obviously, there's some sympathetic elements here, but it doesn't qualify under this exception. I think the court's analysis ends there because they are, in fact, the same thing under the Sanchez case and under the Cannon case.
Can I ask you to talk to me about the Sanchez case? So I'm just looking at that. And to understand, all right, so in Sanchez, it looks like it, for post-conviction relief, he argued that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated by an unreasonable search and seizure. Then he argued, the appellant in that case, that his Sixth Amendment rights were violated by ineffective assistance of counsel. And I feel like the ineffective assistance of counsel was failing to file an appeal that I think was the actual. And then we get into that, like what is the interest of justice exception mean? When does it get measured from? When does a claim arise, et cetera? And then the Supreme Court says, you know, it can't be the same substantive claim, but then goes on to decide factually when the claim arose, and it was when he learned that his appeal was not filed, et cetera. I'm just having a little trouble understanding, like, if that was a substantive issue, ineffective assistance of counsel for not filing appeal, why did the Supreme Court go on to analyze when his claim in fact arose? And it seemed to be pegged to when he was informed that there was no appeal. I'm trying to put that all together because it seems like there was an inquiry into when it arose, and it seems actually a little bit subjective, I guess. Well, I guess he should have known that his counsel was ineffective once he learned there was no appeal file. Is that objective? I guess so. Can you tell me why that's different than this? I mean, it seems like sort of the same issue, ineffective assistance of counsel in both realms, appellate counsel in that case and trial counsel here.
I guess, Your Honor, my answer would first be that I think the additional analysis that the court goes through in the Sanchez case would be unnecessary analysis in light of that holding that they have that says that the reason the petition was filed after the 2-year limit or the interest of justice exception relates to the reason it was filed after the 2-year limit, not the substantive claims in the petition, the fact that the Supreme Court went on to do, you know, but even if kind of analysis, I don't think changes that holding in the Sanchez opinion. And in fact, I think, and as Your Honor noted, that the Hannon versus State opinion in the quote that the state quoted in its brief, I think also shows that, you know, these are separate analysis. You don't have to go to that second step of the analysis. If you don't qualify of the interest of justice exception, perhaps the Supreme Court is doing that, you know, to provide some context for cases when it seems like the interest of justice exception and its limitations may be pretty hard to say, you know, but even if they won't qualify anyway. And certainly if this court, you know, for some reason would not believe that they are the same, which of course I think is clear that in this case, the reason that the petition was filed late was the same as the substantive claim here to the, it is clear that it's the petition was filed more than 2 years after the claim arose. We've already talked about attorney number two. The testimony at the post-conviction hearing was pretty clear that in 2010, Mr. Martinez Fuentes spoke with an attorney. He said, the quote that Mr. Martinez Fuentes' response was that attorney number two didn't say for sure. He said to wait, maybe the immigration laws would change. The assistant county attorney asked, it was your understanding that day that you weren't going to be able to successfully complete your immigration unless things changed. Mr. Martinez Fuentes said yes. So that exchange right there indicates that he had talked to this attorney number two. He was aware that he would not be able to complete his immigration at that time. The distinction appellant appears to try and to draw in their brief, and then again at this oral argument here today, is that somehow it's different and he didn't know until he was specifically told, no, I can't file. I'm barred forever from immigration relief is a distinction without a meaning. His situation in 2010 was that he could not apply for immigration relief unless the immigration laws changed. That remains true in 2019 and true today. He is not eligible to apply for immigration relief unless the immigration laws changed. It's always possible they could change, but obviously he's not entitled to any immigration relief unless that changes. So there's no meaning there. He, under Sanchez, it's a new or should have known. He clearly should have known based on the statements through his own testimony of what he knew from attorney number two in 2010 that he could not apply. He could not complete his immigration status at that time. Appellant's argument here today seems to somewhat insinuate that attorney number two should have told Mr. Martinez Fuentes that he needed to apply for a petition for post-conviction relief at that time. But appellant's comments have made it clear that she is not contesting that attorney number two provided ineffective assistance of counsel, and certainly that claim was never raised below.
Would she have needed to allege ineffective assistance of counsel against attorney number two if the argument is that, attorney number two provided some information, i.e. there's nothing that can be done, but not the complete information, i.e. You can file a post-conviction petition?
I think the review that this court is doing is when he knew or should have known, basically that something went wrong, that he had a claim, right? It's not that he knew or should have, that he knew that a post-conviction petition should be filed. It's that he knew of the substance of what would create the claim, which here is the substance of when was he told of the facts that caused the first attorney's representation to be erroneous. So the fact that the second attorney doesn't, for all we know, doesn't specifically say you need to go file a petition for post-conviction relief at that time, I think is completely irrelevant to this court's analysis of when is the substance of the claim known by the claimant. That's the analysis done under Sanchez, and that's what was done in 2010 is when attorney number two told him of his inability to complete his immigration. That's when that arose. So this whole talk about post-conviction relief, ineffective assistance of attorney number two, that's completely relevant, I think, to this court's analysis.
Just to clarify your answer, Ms. Passy, when we talk about knew or should have known, now we're focusing on 4C, when the claim arose, correct? So that does presuppose an interest of justice. So in looking at the court's order, and I'm agreeing with my colleagues, it appears that the court really focused on 2010, that discussion. So it seems to presuppose, and it seems like the record supports this conclusion, that is the distinction in Sanchez of not conflating the underlying petition with the merits of the petition of ineffective assistance of counsel with the reason for the delay. It seems like that has to be conflated here naturally, meaning if it seems undisputed, largely undisputed, I think that the immigration expert told him be no problem. Hence, he took no action until 2010. So it seems like this might be the unique situation. We normally have situations in these scenarios where defense counsel consulted with an immigration expert who said, well, you shouldn't be a problem, but it really wasn't defense attorney's issue. It was some advice. And so the ineffective assistance might not be part of the reason for the delay. But here it seems the very reason that he did nothing was because he was specifically told you're fine. So until 2010. So that suggests to me that maybe we are if I understand Sanchez well enough, we are past the interests of justice, but now it is an issue of when the claim arose, and hence the judge focused on 2010, knew or should have known. Would that be a fair summary based on the record and at least your alternative argument, Ms. Passy?
Well, Your Honor, I think the district court did in fact conclude that it didn't meet the interest of justice exception, but I would agree that even if in fact the interest of justice exception, for some reason, we get past that in this case and we get to the timeliness issue, I think certainly the timeliness issue is controlling here and would prevent appellant from having any kind of relief in this case. In addition to the, of course, even if this court were to reach the merits of this case, Padilla is obviously a well-known, Padilla is an important decision, but it doesn't apply retroactively, as we know from the Campos versus State case from the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Chavez versus U.S. case from the U.S. Supreme Court. So it wouldn't apply.
Is this really a Padilla issue, though? I mean, Padilla has to do with an obligation on the part of counsel to provide an advisory. Here, it sounds like the claim is that actually the attorney affirmatively misled Mr. Martinez about the consequences of the plea. And is there a distinction there? Does the law recognize a distinction there?
The law does recognize a distinction there, Your Honor. And I think at least the way that appellant framed the argument in their brief was that there's two misrepresentations that made. One, they didn't tell him that he was going to be deported if he in fact pleaded guilty. So that's the Padilla issue. And that is clearly barred under the case law of Minnesota that was in effect at the time, which is the Alanis versus State case, which said that, you know, this is a collateral issue, not a direct issue. So that part is barred, yes. The second issue is recognized by case law that, you know, affirmative misrepresentation of the attorney, that can be a problem. That is not necessarily a Padilla issue. That is more, you can't affirmatively misrepresent someone, misrepresent the immigration consequences even prior to the Padilla decision. That is true. Here our record isn't particularly clear what the what the plea attorney told Mr. Martinez Fuentes. Mr. Martinez, attorney number one, did not testify was not called by the petitioner to testify at the post-conviction hearing. That is, of course, his burden to show entitlements to post-conviction relief. So his statements would be
don't we have a factual finding from the district court crediting the testimony of Mr. Martinez about what he was told? I mean, I don't know that we need the testimony of the attorney given that factual finding.
Your Honor, I would actually, I guess I would disagree that the district court credited the testimony of Mr. Martinez Fuentes. I would point Your Honor to pages 9 and 10 of the district court's order, where essentially the court's doing an even if analysis based as even if petitioner's post-conviction hearing testimony could be deemed to be credible, petitioner cannot meet the exception to the 2-year time bar. So that statement by the district court indicates that the district court did not find Mr. Martinez Fuentes's testimony to be credible when it was evaluating the post-conviction petition. So I don't, certainly that is a determination by the district court on the credibility of witnesses that I do not think this court would not overturn in the absence of a clearly erroneous factual finding. I don't think there's anything in the record here that could lead this court to conclude that factual finding is clearly erroneous on the credibility determination. So I think that fails as well because the district court did not find his testimony to be credible. Unless the court has any further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Sorry, Ms. Woods, you will now have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Once you see the 5 minutes up on the screen, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. So thank you, Your Honors. First of all, I disagree with counsel's representation that the district court found the appellant to be not credible. That is not stated at all. Secondly, the district court did in fact find on page 7 of its order, based on these allegations, the petition is not frivolous and is construed to invoke the interest of justice exception to the 2-year time limit. And then the court begins its analysis about the injustice causing the petitioner to miss the primary deadline. So in this case, the attorney number one affirmatively misled the appellant, stating not only, oh, you won't have any problems with your immigration, but come see me and I will easily fix your immigration status. So not only said, don't worry about the plea, but said, I can take care of everything, you'll be fine, essentially. So the appellant relied on that advice. Of course, he believed his defense attorney, who was also an immigration attorney, when his attorney told him, don't worry about the plea, come back and see me, you'll be fine. The only issue really is when the claim arose, when the appellant knew or should have known that he had a claim.
So it sounds, I mean, my impression of the dispute between counsel, and forgive me if I'm mischaracterizing it, is that you, Ms. Woods Vinslow, are arguing that he became aware of the claim when he learned of the remedy for the claim. And Ms. Passy is arguing it doesn't matter when he learned about the remedy for the claim, the salient date is when he learned that he had a claim. And I guess I, given the case law, have a little bit of trouble wrapping my head around your argument that it was, you know, when he learned of the claim plus what he might be able to do in order to pursue it. And maybe you could help me with that.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is when Mr. Martinez knew he was prejudiced by, or when he became prejudiced by the bad advice, or when he knew he became prejudiced by the erroneous advice. So when he saw attorney number 2 in 2010, and they said, we can't do anything unless laws changed. Mr. Martinez, again, I know I keep saying he did not know that he could never apply for anything, that he would be forever prejudiced until 2019 when he met with attorney number 3. And so in 2010, he believed there was some hope. He thought, that means that someday the laws will change or my position's going to be different. But that's not the case. And he did not know that until 2019. And that's when he knew he was truly prejudiced by this advice. So the appellant maintains that he knew he was prejudiced in November of 2019 when he met with Mr. Nguyen and was told, we can't do anything for you. There's no way you can ever fix your immigration status. And it's because of this plea, it's because of this conviction, and there's nothing that we can do to help you. So we are asking that the appellate court overturn the district court's decision. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate the answers you have for our questions today and the briefs you submitted. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. And you each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.